two panelists today, Dean Scott Cutlip, who just spoke to you, and Pat Jackson, who I introduced in the audience, who's president of PRSA. The one reason that this is a mini session, a breakout session for on our agenda, it really kind of started as far as discussions, the type of discussions that we've been carrying on for the past over a year now, was when we heard Pat Jackson speak at a Southern Public Relations Federation annual conference in New Orleans a year ago last summer. And the message, the theme, was an ecumenical theme. Why should not professional communications organizations work together? They have common goals, unity and strength, and we hearken to his message. Of course, those of you who were at our annual meeting last year in Sarasota know that Pat came and spoke to us. At that time, we began discussions with PRSA. Don Turk, I named him as chair of that committee, and he has worked with Dick Qualley and Patsy Trubo. And what has Don actually met with, and of course, Pat Jackson has spearheaded this effort, and I'm going to have him speak in just a moment. Don went to a meeting in Chicago a few weeks ago with, a gathering of something like 15 identifiable organizations in professional communications. What has resulted so far is the fact that the executive committee of FPRA has voted to endorse a task force report from Phil Leslie, certainly a noted practitioner, task force on the stature and role of public relations and cooperating associations. We've voted to support a profession-wide accreditation movement. This is something that we're, by the voting to endorse, we're moving towards that. We're also voted to support a profession-wide code of professional standards. At this point, that's where we are. At this moment, our discussions are continuing. I would like to, we can move off in virtually any direction, but I'm going to call upon Pat Jackson at this point to amplify his own thoughts on where our profession is going. Pat?
I think the best way to examine where a field is going, and most of you, if you've been to your own meetings or to SPRF meetings, you've heard me on this subject until I'm sure you're tired of it. By the way, Scott, remember that picture you and I were set up for in New Orleans? There's a guy in the audience here who set it up, and afterwards I want to talk to you about that. You've all heard my famous story about the completely new dancing picture. Well, we finally got into that one. The best way to find out where a field is going, unfortunately, is not to talk to guys like me that have a preconception that they're outselling about where they think it ought to go, but is to look at what's actually happening. Because while you need both, we as practitioners know you need the planning. You need to push it where you think it ought to go. You also need the feedback, the response of whether your pushing is being effective. So let me just quickly go over some very recent history and see whether the things that we've been talking about are coming true. I'm thinking of the history of three specific companies, and this could be three hospitals or school boards. It's just that these have had such widespread publicity that I'm sure we're all familiar with them. I'm thinking of the Hooker Chemical Company and its Love Canal situation. I'm thinking of the Firestone Rubber Company and its 500 tire recall. And I'm thinking of the Procter & Gamble Company and its Rely tampon problem. If you look at those three situations, I believe some interesting results emerge. Hooker Chemical Company is totally, on a factual basis, in the court of law, totally innocent in Love Canal. They sold the land 25 years ago. At the time, they filled that canal according to the best-known technical standards of the day. They gave the land, really, to the local school board for $1, and in the deed, they wrote in some prescriptions as to what the school board could not do. The school board proceeded to run a road over the top of Love Canal, dig gravel away from the sides to fill a hole somewhere. And the predictable results were that, of course, when they had a bad rain, the chemicals no longer had the support. They rose out the top, and the problem resulted. In the court of law, they are undoubtedly going to be exonerated. In the court of public opinion, there is some question whether the Hooker Chemical Company will fail because of the difficulties that they are having. They had no public relations professionals on staff at the time. When management was asked to explain themselves, they sent their lawyer, whose one statement was, "It isn't our fault." So one thing he could say was, "It isn't our fault." Now let's examine Firestone. In 1973, the government first identified problems with their tires. For 7 years, they fought and ducked and bucked and wouldn't admit anything, wouldn't take any positive steps. They do have a highly respected public relations professional in charge of a relatively sizable public relations operation. I have not had a chance to talk to Barney Frazier. At least Barney hasn't been willing to talk to me in my role as editor of a newsletter, off, you know, telling me really what happened. I know Barney well enough to think that probably somebody else in the company was saying, you know, "We're not going to hear you. This is what we have to do." The result is, well, I guess you all know the result. There is some serious question whether Firestone Rubber will indeed survive because of the terrible effect on its sales, on its internal operations, and so forth. Now let's look at Procter & Gamble. Their product is suddenly linked with a serious illness. It affects relatively few individuals, but nonetheless, it's very serious when it does. What do? They immediately, voluntarily pull the product off the market, start doing some good work in terms of getting the word out about their caring for the individuals who might be involved. Now, P&G has a public relations staff. They are not noted for openness and candor about their operations, but it's not that they're cover-up artists. It's just that, as you know, their business is almost totally, it's very much like the cosmetic business. As if you've ever talked to a dermatologist, you probably know that Americans buy about 50 times more soap than we need, take a hell of a lot more baths than are even healthy for most of us because of the effect on the skin. And P&G has more or less talked us into this with some rather good work over the years. So even though they're not an out-front company in terms of institutional public relations, they are definitely linked and understand their link with their publics. All right, now let's examine the net result. Love Canal has not killed anybody. It has not even done, as yet, identifiable physical harm. It has done some material damage, homes that really shouldn't be lived in, and as you know, the government put up a lot of money to move people elsewhere, but no one has died as a result of Love Canal. The company is hated. Some people may have died from the Firestone tire situation. The government is currently investigating that, as I understand it. But if so, it isn't many. And yet, Firestone is disliked so much in the marketplace, they may go broke. 120 people have died identifiably from the illness that the tampon is very closely linked to, and the best medical evidence from the government is that it may very well be the cause of, and Procter & Gamble is being cheered. I ask you, was public relations involved in this? Does somebody know how to deal with the people? Can somebody else not know how to deal with the people? I think the evidence is insurmountable. And what it tells me is that our role to forget the publicity, the hype, and to deal in what the field talks about, public relations. Can we build relationships with people that will tide us over the good times and the bad? That's first. Can we emphasize the relationship aspect? Like a friendship, it carries on over time because there's trust and confidence and credibility built up. And secondly, can we learn how to anticipate and plan rather than just respond? In other words, can we be involved in policy setting within our organizations instead of just being the fire truck out there that they call when there is a fire? I think these are proof positive. Let me just give you a couple of other examples. The tourist industries in Oregon and Washington are in shambles. Even other businesses there are suffering because of Mount St. Helens. in our newsletter, I was interested in how that was happening because, as you know, the facts are that a very small part of those states that are involved in tourism have been affected by the eruptions. And we did a story in PR Reporter not long ago which showed that the Mount St. Helens disaster was like the Three Mile Island disaster, basically a public relations disaster, that nobody out there knew how to handle it, how to deal with the media. They didn't let the media in, and so instead of ever getting a good word out about the fact that it's okay to come to Seattle, you know, because the wind's blowing in the other direction, all that they got was a very negative response all over the country. And certainly anybody who works for Bendix knows that there's a time to tell Bill Agee to shut his mouth. And the trouble is, you see, Bill sort of built himself into a corner, didn't he? He appointed a person with no professional training to be his vice president for public affairs, and then when that same person was the center of a controversy, he had no professional to turn to know when to communicate and when not to communicate. What this tells me, and of course I'm glad of this, guy, because this is what I've been saying right along, is that communications is not enough. We are not essentially communicators anymore. Instead, we must learn to be two other things. The reason I don't think we're communicators is because, like it or not, going back to the actualities, communicators in our institutions have generally been thought of as truck drivers. Somebody else decides they want to send a package. They call us. You're the truck driver. Delivery. Here you are, delivery boy, delivery girl. Get this package out. Well, I don't want to be involved in that because I might be involved in a Firestone 500 or in a Love Canal, which would put me in a tremendously difficult professional situation and really a difficult ethical situation. And ethics is still the guts of any profession. Instead, I want to be involved in asking the questions that come before there is any communication. A, should we communicate? I wish Bill Agee had been a client of mine because there are times, not to manipulate, but there are times when you don't communicate. I wish Bill, you know, had listened to Dickie Nixon saying, I'm no crook. Because anybody, I mean, I don't know, this guy must be awfully naive. I would certainly never go home, you know, to my spouse and say, well, gee, honey, I'm not running around. Because if that came out of the blue, I imagine I might be raising a few issues that weren't there before, you see. Well, you know, AG's, I guess he's getting a divorce and single, and he'd forgotten all about that. But it seems to me the question of should we communicate? If so, what should we communicate? How should we do it? And even far more important than those communication-based questions are these questions. What is our relationship with the public to which we're going to communicate? In other words, what's the behavioral effect that we might be able to anticipate if we do communicate? Or what behavior do we hope to influence if we communicate? Those are just some of the many questions that have to come first, and then that basic one. What are our organizational policies? And how do they affect this communication? Are we just talking? Or can we, in fact, communicate because we've got policies that back it up? Have we got performance for which we can win recognition? Or are we trying to win recognition when we really don't deserve any? Those are the questions that make a communication effective if it's to take place. I think that's where we have to be involved. The result is that our number one skill is not communication, as I see it. It cannot be communication.
Well, I can bring it down there.
Never mind. I was just going to put it up because we all know that if you make people read it as well as hear it, it makes twice the impact. That's learning theory, something else we need to know. In any event, the first skill we have is the counseling skill. Now, good counselors are born, not made. I have to warn you of that. But they are skills that can be learned. We need to learn them. We need to be counselors first. Are we communicators second? No, not quite. There's one other thing I believe we have to do. You and I know that we cannot handle the public relations for our clients or our employers. No one person, no staff can do that. We aren't the ones that determine the relationships we're going to have with the public. Let me give you, you know, my famous example where the company spends several thousand dollars a year on a public relations campaign. They do this for years, and I think, hey, that's a pretty good company. And I call up, and the girl on the switchboard says, yes. Well, forget it. I mean, they might as well have saved the dough and had a big company picnic, and everything is fine as far as I'm concerned. And you all know examples of this. Okay. To me, what that says is that the public relationships of an organization, honestly viewed, are the relationships of all the people in that organization and the publics with which they work and depend upon for viability. Therefore, we don't handle anybody's public relations. We merely advise the members of that organization how to do it, and we must motivate every person in that outfit to realize they have a public relations role. Therefore, I hope none of you are ex-school teachers, because the fact is, we are school teachers. We must be educators. And that's our second highest skill, because if we don't do that, the organization cannot speak with one clear voice. Let me quickly prove my point, because I'm probably already eating into everybody's time. That's a public relations strategy, by the way. I'll tell you about that later. The National School Public Relations Association did a survey 2 years ago. They wanted to find out, you know, who really has credibility with the school district. And here is what their study found. The most credible person in the school district is the janitor. Because this is no BS now. I'd be glad to send you a copy of the study. Because the janitor's job description includes time when the children are coming to school, when, you know, he leans up against the building out in front and sees that nobody gets run over by trucks. That's part of his job. The result is, parents who do bring kids to school see the janitor. There he is. He's visible, and you can go up to him and say, hey, what's really going on? You know, he's a janitor. He doesn't give a damn. He'll tell you. Okay? The next most credible person was the lady who's, and usually it is a lady, who scoops up the mashed potatoes at school lunch. Right? Because, again, she's a member of the community, works part-time. She doesn't give a damn. She'll tell it like it is. Not only that, she knows all the good gossip. Okay? Thirdly, the third person they found was the secretary. Usually it's a she, and usually she's in the principal's office. And when parents call, they found they don't even ask for the principal. They don't want to talk to the principal. They want to talk to her. She'll tell it like it is, and, you know, she looks around, puts her hand over the mouthpiece, and tells it. The fourth most credible source, way down from that, was the teacher. At the very bottom of the study was the principal. Hardly ever mentioned was the superintendent and the school board. And the ENSPRA members suddenly said, oh, my God, we always put out the news from whom? The superintendent and the school board. The least credible source is the one we're constantly pushing out there. No wonder we got a problem. Further, the study found a very damaging thing. The leading critic, and here's where they did have credibility, the leading critic of our school system, teachers. They're articulate, they go to parties, and they say, that principal of mine, or that stupid school board, they got a problem. I hope it makes a point. We have to be educators. Right now, ENSPRA, for example, one of their major goals, I kicked off the school year in the second largest school district in Ohio by invitation to go and give a public relations pitch to all their 1,100 teachers in the system to see if we could get them thinking about their role in public relations. That's ENSPRA's on a real campaign, understanding they have to get everybody in the organization on board. All right, I think that, therefore, we are counselors first, and must be. We are educators second. And that, by the way, means learning something about learning theory. It's a fascinating subject. The beauty of learning theory to me is that I happen to believe, Scott will disagree with this totally, he's wrong, but anyway. I happen to believe that of all the behavioral science findings, and many of you have heard me say this, I still believe the diffusion process is the most important one we need to know in terms of our communications role. The beauty of learning theory is that it almost totally dovetails and supports diffusion process, which to me adds credibility to both of those. I think we need to be counselors first, educators second, and then we need to be communicators. And that isn't to say we need to be less capable as communicators than we are to be professionals. We need to be more capable. So if we think we're halfway decent communicators, the bad news is that it's really back to school time, because we need to be better than we are now as communicators, plus becoming educators and becoming counselors. It's not easy, but I think that is where our future lies. And let me just prove my point with some little free advertising here. Our newsletter, PR Reporter, does an annual survey of the profession. We've been doing it for 16 years. We asked our 600 respondents. What we do is we sample PRSA, FPRA, or a whole list of organizations. We take one in every 20th, you know, of their members and do a sampling to do this survey. And one of the questions we asked them this year was the one we're discussing today, and here's what people said. A public relations firm in Washington, D.C. said that that what we had to do now was to establish our role as more than pure messengers by winning acceptance as the best-informed managers of issues and interpreters of trends. In other words, this whole idea of anticipation. Another one said that the opportunity now is for the function to prove itself capable of doing the social monitoring required, the kind of things that P&G obviously had done quite well in knowing how people respond when a company gets into trouble on a product. Another person said we had to become catalysts for social understanding in countering society's fragmentation. I think that there's a lot of evidence for the points I'm making. I hope you'll take them to heart. There's one thing more that needs to be said, however, and that is that the education that we give ourselves as practitioners is probably now starting to rise to this level. PRSA's Institute next year is going to be totally devoted to organization development, dealing with quality of work life and a whole lot of subjects that ought to be part of our turf. I have some serious questions about our undergraduate education. I think we are going to have to move away from the journalism mode, even if we house it in the School of Journalism. I don't care where you house it. Put it in the German department. They got a lot of extra teachers and empty chairs there. But I think we have to increasingly recognize that we are totally different than the journalists today. They are no longer functions that complement one another. Scott, he's really going to disagree with that, but that's all right. I think we have to change the tenor of it, and steps are being taken in that direction. More importantly, I think anyone coming into this field within 5 years that wants to be seriously considered a professional is going to have at least a master's degree. And I think those of us who are accredited can learn something from your own accreditation system, whereas I understand it, your CPRC requires every 2 years that you reprove that you know something. Now, that one shakes me up a little bit, but I think we're going to be there. I know in PRSA we're going to be there probably this year. Our counselor section, I think, is about to pass that, and our national organization is looking very closely at making accreditation something you have to re-up probably every 5 years. That's where I see us going, and now I'll give the other two guys a chance to show me I'm wrong.
I'm sure we're going to have some. Thanks, Pat. I know we're going to have some questions, and I hate to call Dean Cutler back to the podium right after he spoke to us this morning, but I do feel like perhaps that Pat Jackson and Scott Cutler don't see eye to eye on everything, so they were thoroughly confused. I thought maybe if we could call, could you respond?
First, I want to sort of put a couple footnotes on the things that Pat said with which I agree, and then I want to take on the role of educator and try to relieve his ignorance about public relations education. Just a corollary of the Firestone radio story. We have our stereotype of the French, and we think they're pretty stuffy, haughty folks. The company that is doing it, the Firestone, with Firestone's help, is Michelin. Now, 3 years ago, when Michelin decided to go national in the United States, marketing its radio tire, they picked a very bright young man who had 7 years experience in their public affairs department in Paris, a lawyer trained, by the way, and they sent him. They understood that public relations in the United States is not public relations in France, and they sent him to our school for a year study to prepare him for handling Michelin's public relations in the United States. He's obviously doing a very superb job. On this matter of motivating your personnel who are your public relations ambassadors, I would urge you to study Delta Airlines. They have a very small core of PR professionals, but they have 30-some thousand public relations representatives dealing with the public. I think many organizations could well copy and emulate Delta. On the diffusion process, Pat, I don't disagree. I fully agree. And that's why it's in the book. Just stop and think a minute about how important the diffusion process is and how time-tested it is. The pioneer in the use of the diffusion process has been our U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Extension Information System that has built American agriculture. Today, we forget that we were once a rural or agrarian society. We didn't move over the line to industry until the 1900 census. That was the first census showed more people employed in industry than in agriculture. Today, 4% of our people are providing more than enough food and fiber for our people and exporting it abroad. Why? Because of the diffusion process. The research, and as we develop new knowledge, we carried it out to the farm and the farm wife through the diffusion process. Anybody who looks at the story of American agriculture and then doubts the validity of the diffusion process is dense indeed. And speaking of denseness, Pat, I don't know how many times we in public relations education are going to have to explain the fact that the School of Journalism and Communication, which teaches opinion research and analysis along with all other aspects of research and communication, is the only logical home for public relations education on the campus. It is the only hospitable home for public relations education on the campus. And you and PRSA, I know this, you've been beating your brains out for 20 years to get colleges of business to teach it, and they won't touch it. Well,
I don't want it done.
Well, I don't either, but it's, and you, the idea of creating a separate school of public relations, your own BU proved what a disaster that is. To be effective in teaching and education, you have to have the acceptance of your colleagues. And no department or school of public relations will ever be accepted on a first-rate university campus. Now, you can just put that in your pipe and smoke it. We don't confuse public relations with journalism because it's housed in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Our school would be a school of mass communication if I didn't want a PR problem with the newspapers of the state. Now, there are schools, and you know them, that won't teach public relations because they are afraid of the newspaper editor of the state, but we're not in that category. There are about 15 strong, accredited programs of public relations education in the country are doing one hell of a job, and the record of our graduates proves it. For example, the current, as well as five of his predecessors, Chief of Army Information, was one of my, or were my students. Their track record is there, and I don't know where you would house it or who would teach it if you were to move it out of schools of communication. And we don't confuse public relations with news editorial. They're separate sequences and separate programs. And I thought you understood that.
Let me thank you. This, in a sense, is like a preamble to the Phil Leslie report. I'm gonna read it carry on what we're talking about, and then we'll kind of open the floor to some questions. But this is the reason for the task force report on the status and future of public relations. Time and circumstances confront the public relations field with its greatest opportunity and its greatest danger. Civilization is in a major transition. all over the world, relations between people and organizations are in flux. All relationships are under stress. The pressures of change involve transformations in people's attitudes and how they relate to all organizations and institutions. Clearly, means of reconciling institutions and restive people are vital. Established means are being questioned. Public relations, as it is perceived by sophisticated practitioners, encompasses new means and processes. Whether the public relations field will rise on the crest of new needs depends on one, how public relations people perform, two, how new practitioners are educated and developed, three, how the field is perceived by those who need its services, and four, how it adapts to the multiple demands of the emerging era. This condition creates a crossroads. Public relations will either become recognized as an indispensable key to all organizations' viability, or it will be relegated to merely carrying out a range of useful techniques. The significance of this goes far beyond the personal interests of those in public relations. Sophisticated public relations is a vital instrument for accommodating the conflicting forces in society. If it functions at the decision-making level of all organizations and institutions, it forestalls conflict and facilitates adjustments. If its true benefits are bypassed because decision-makers slight its role, the future of the social system will be affected adversely. And so on this note, I would like to open the floor to questions to the, and I'm going to, because we are on tape, I'm going to ask if whether the question is to Pat Jackson or Scott Cutlop, if you would, or myself, if they would repeat the question into the microphone. Thank you.
The question was to comment on the broadcast media's use of polls and publicizing the results. That's one part of it, I guess. And then the second part is on their reporting on the results in one state before another state has finished voting. Probably the worst example. No? All right. Oh, you mean showing the map all the time as if the votes had been cast? Right. 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 Does this become a self-fulfilling prophecy, for example? I think we need only look at the recent Canadian election to see what was done there in an actual elective situation, to see the possible influence of that in this most recent Canadian election. As you know, the whole future of Canada was involved in the two candidates, and at least that's the way it was perceived because of the new constitution that was going to be promulgated shortly after the election. I think one of the networks was broadcasting in British Columbia the actual results of the voting in Ontario and in Quebec, which are the two major provinces in terms of population. And it seems to me that that kind of thing can only be deleterious. I think that this shows, again, a failure not so much on our part. I would take our journalist friends to task on this. I think it's that same old question of journalists have to decide whether their role is to report the news or to attempt to make the news. And I can't see anything in that except making the news. Can you imagine you as a practitioner going to the media with a story that was based on that kind of speculation? What would they tell you? Get out of here. Prove it to me. But when they do it, seems to be a different kind of a thing.
The political public opinion poll uses opinion polling in a way it was not designed and is not equipped to be used. No one has argued longer or harder than I about the importance of measuring public opinion periodically as a way of being able to deal with it effectively. Now, the networks and the newspapers do put in the escape clause. There's a margin of error of 3%. But the public opinion poll measures public opinion at a point in time, and that stream of public opinion is always in motion. It is not, the poll was never equipped, and it cannot be used to predict opinion. So I think this intensive polling that we're getting, and it's done strictly for audience. After all, the media make their money by delivering an audience, and you, by providing excitement, and this is what I was talking about this morning, of going completely to this horse race coverage of a political campaign, who's ahead, who's falling behind, and why. That is has done great damage to our public dialogue. And so I think we've just become, and it's a competitive thing. It's the newspaper, this network's way of competing with the newspapers. And of course, the Lou Harris's and the Gallup's and the others sell these polls to the media as a way of financing their organizations and keeping themselves in business. It's a market, it's a marketing thing with the polling agencies. But it is, I agree with Pat on this, it is injurious to our political process.
Barry Epstein.
Pat, how would you advise the Reagan campaign to overcome the Iranian ploy to release the hostages prior to the election?
The question is how I would counsel, if I were counseling the Reagan campaign to overcome the ploy to release the hostages. I think I would stay off that subject if I were advising the Reagans, because clearly the sitting administration can overcome anything Reagan says. It is absolutely true that they have been trying, as far as we all know, to get the hostages released for a year. So there's just no way that that can win. I think if I were Reagan, I would, if I talked about it all, if it happens, I would applaud it, say, gee, that's great. You know, we've all been involved in this, not let the president get the benefit of that. That is one of the things, however, that goes beyond even the public relations influence or the media influence, which we've seen in this election, that is really destroying the democratic process, and that is the use of the incumbent, use by the incumbent of things that up until now I think we all would have thought rather unethical. I had a situation in the fall before the New Hampshire primaries where one of our clients, we had made an application for a $5,000 DOE grant on a new building that involves solar energy, and we were turned down flat. In January, the cabinet secretary himself brought us a check for $75,000. That's what you're up against.
We have a question here.
Let me ask Jackson one sort of less over sort of thing, I suppose, but I'm curious about the back to the future of the profession and professional organizations. We've had development of geographically centered PR organizations like BART PR Association. We've had specialty groups like INSPRA, who you just cited. The coalitions like CASE, and what do you see as the future? Because the contacts here between and amongst the organizations, I believe, have centered around you and your efforts here in the last 2 years.
Right.
Do you see a merging? Do you see a reciprocity thing developing? Or a geographically centered member goes somewhere else? Where will you find a home?
Right. Well, what I see is this, and the vision that I, you know, began the dialogue with, and I guess I do probably have to take the blame for that, but my feeling was I have this unusual approach, I guess, to the field in that we do the newsletter and I have a far-out consulting practice and I teach part-time and I've been active in, you know, organizations. And from all of that, the thing I kept seeing was that this could be a CASE meeting, this could be an ENSPRA meeting, this could be a PRSA meeting, could be an IABC meeting. Increasingly, they probably wouldn't quite be into this. They don't seem that concerned with these kind of issues. But wherever I went, I just saw all of us together. And I said, you know, as the Leslie Report says, we have this fantastic opportunity, but we have to professionalize. By the same token, what we do has been accepted by all the other professions. You know, for years after putting us down, all the lawyers, all the accountants, all the management consultants now talk about themselves as public relations experts in addition. We've been discovered. So I saw both a danger and an opportunity, And I said, if we keep up all this turf business, we're going to be busy fighting over, you know, whether I can get Susie to join my organization or whether you can get her to join yours. In the meantime, the lawyers are going to be doing our work. So I said, look, that's foolish. And here's what I see. Ultimately, way out there someplace, and I wouldn't care if it's next year or 10 years, 20 years, I see through some organizational mechanism or other, an umbrella organization or a coalition of organizations, I don't give a darn, that handles the nitty-gritty, the single computer system that has all the data about the field and who's a member and, you know, what their specialties are, all that stuff, that handles ethics. We have a single ethical code that every organization supports, and the enforcement mechanism spreads across organizations so that if I violate, I can't even count on having a judicial panel made up of my fellow PRSA members. You see, now that may be somebody in Enspra from California, doesn't know me from beans, but is very upset that I may be transgressing. Then, accreditation. You know, if I were a school practitioner in your state, I could now have four sets of initials after my name, and my feeling is that that's going to make a laughingstock of the whole idea. So to me, the answer is get one accreditation. It's the same. If you accredit them, we accredit them. They've done the same stuff. They are worthy, by all of our agreement, of being accredited. So someday I see a big national organization doing that, and I see the energy then shifting down to what would be the local groups, both on a state and a local level, regional and local level, the chapters, as we all call them. That's where a lot of it ought to be anyway. Who the heck can afford to run all around the country these days, either in time or money? And I see it shifting then also to what in PRSA we call sections, or what would be the cases in the ENSPRAs. So that an individual has this big organization in which we're all united, we're all in the tent, pursuing the same kind of things and debating among ourselves what the course will be in a democratic fashion. And then we also belong to a specialty organization in the field we're working in at the moment, and I emphasize that because today, you know, well, ENSPRA, heck, their immediate past president had to resign from the board of directors because from being a school public relations practitioner, he's now the head public relations vice president for a big national trade association. You know, people move around. So whatever you're in at the moment, you are there. And that section probably is the one that awards the recognition which goes beyond accreditation, a fellowship probably kind of a program, so that I don't think the big organization ever ought to make anybody a fellow. That says an awful lot about a person. If you notice,